You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards.
On today's episode, I have a great chat with writer-director Andrew Heckler about his new film, Burden. It's a powerful, independent film that won the Audience Award at Sundance and stars Garrett Hedlund, Forrest Whitaker, Tom Wilkinson, and Usher. It's based on a true story about what happens when a museum celebrating the Ku Klux Klan opens in a small South Carolina town. But before I get to Andrew, I want to let you know that I have a couple really exciting podcasts coming in the next couple weeks. I chat with writer-director Lee Winnell about The Invisible Man. You probably know Lee best as the creator of the Saw franchise. Also, I speak with Chris Henchy, who directed the new film, Impractical Jokers the Movie. If you're a fan of the TV show Impractical Jokers, you'll definitely want to check this out. All right, let's get back to Andrew. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being on the podcast. Now, you spent much of your life as a fairly successful theater actor.
Successful, yeah. I was successful. I had a theater company in New York. That I'm most proud of back in the day where I acted and produced and directed and wrote. We had all of these great people down in downtown Tribeca participating in the theater and the theater company. And so there was a lot of acting to be done on stage. We were terrible fundraisers, so it forced us to do a lot of work all the time so people could buy tickets. But it was an amazing place. And from there, yeah, to support that theater, New York actors had to do commercials and such. And so that became, that started my film career and television career. So I was very fortunate to be able to get work, and support, it was basically to support my theater habit.
What kind of shows did you do? Did you ever write any plays or did you do traditional stuff?
We did all sorts of stuff. We were sort of an experimental theater, and in terms of whatever was kitchen sink dramas, we would push out there and make more experimental. Whatever was very experimental, we would sort of ground and bring down to earth. But we did, our first play, we were lucky enough to do a John Steinbeck piece. And so we did John Steinbeck, we did Mack Wellman, we did John Stepling. We really pushed the boundaries, and it was, sometimes I lament, it was my greatest, for me, until Burden, it was my greatest artistic achievement. And, it was over. We opened this theater, I think I was 23. And it was over by 29, it was over. And so...
just wasn't sustainable financially?
I think unless, like I said, unless you're a great fundraiser, theater is a really youthful game. And at a certain point, you get very tired I would get to the theater and I would, build sets. I would, rehearse with actors. I would do costumes. I would, rehearse the plays. I would put on the plays. I would take down the lights. I would close the theater. I'd pay rent every month. It was insane.
Yeah. I have a theater background as well, which is why I'm so interested.
It was great though. I would not trade it for anything in the world. There were so many great theater companies down there in the 90s in New York. I mean, there was us, and there was Naked Angels, and there was the Actors Studio, and there was Malapart, and there was Ethan Hawke's company, and all of us were there to just do theater, and it was amazing, And so,
What was the name of your theater?
Our theater was Workhouse.
Okay.
Workhouse Theater.
Cool.
Yeah, it was great. Damian Gray was my partner back then. He was him and I, we were kids, and we conspired. Let's not open a theater company. Let's open a theater. And I was like, all right, that sounds great. And I realized I had to pay for it. And I was like, wow.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of your experience helped you put Burden together. Now, Burden is based on a true story.
Correct.
I did not know that until the end of the film.
Yeah.
So it suddenly had this whole new resonance, for me. Tell me how you came to know the true story and then what inspired you to put all this blood, sweat, and tears into writing and directing the film.
Yeah, so I first heard, in 1996, there was a blurb in a newspaper that said, Redneck Shop and KKK Museum opens in a small southern town. And I couldn't believe it, really, you know. And so I clipped the article and I put it in my folder of like projects that I'm interested in. And I had started writing a lot more. I was frustrated with sort of acting in Los Angeles acting. And so I started writing a lot more. So I clipped it, I put it in my folder of things that I'm interested in. And I think it was 8 months later, there was another article that came out and said, Klansman sells redneck shop and KKK museum to Black Baptist minister. And I thought that was nuts. And so I ended up picking up the phone and calling the Reverend David Kennedy. And I said, hey, could I come down there? I'm really interested in this story. And he said, sure, it's free country. So I drove myself, I was living in New York at the time, and I drove myself to Lawrence, South Carolina, where I spent about 10 days, 2 weeks with the Reverend Kennedy and his congregation, getting to know them, getting to know the environment and what it was like. And I then went back figuring I should know more. And I went and spent some time with the Klan at the Redneck Shop and KKK Museum.
Wow.
Yeah, it was...
That is crazy, because to me, it's like mythical. Like, that doesn't really exist, but you're telling me it's real.
It's real, and you know, the... I mean, sort of my objective is, and I always say this about the movie, you know, when you think of Klansmen, you have a certain idea, and it is mythical. And then when you take the hood off the Klansmen, there's actually a person there. And so how do you tell this story about this person and not the idea of the evil? You know, because evil is an idea, it's a concept, depending on where you're sitting, you know. Unfortunately, no Klan member wakes up in the morning, looks in the mirror and goes, I'm going to go out there and do some evil today. You know, they actually, they think that what they're doing is right. And so how do you get on that side? How do you get that perspective? And the only way to do it is by talking to people and listening and understanding and having empathy, no matter what. And so that was the genesis of the story. But the truth of the matter was, when I got down there, the idea that a hardcore Klansman could be converted from, you know, senseless hatred and bigotry and pulled by the love of a woman and the faith of a reverend to tolerance and understanding and love, I thought, man, this is like way too much. And I love stories about what I call the left behinds in American society or any society, which are, you know, small town America, economically challenged people that no one seems to really be representing or care about. And so for some reason, I just care about them. I mean, I'm doing another project about another area of the world that's been left behind in southern, you know, the West Virginia-Kentucky border. And so I just feel like there are heroes there. And there are stories to be told that maybe not even they are aware of how important they could be or how impactful they can be. And Burden is one of those stories. And so... it took 20 years to get it, 23 years to get it to the screen.
At the time, what made you think, you know what, I can write this screenplay? Or did you write it as a play first?
No, it's a screenplay. I felt, you know, there was something about going down there. There was something about the way people talked about it. There was something about the telling of the story that I just naturally knew I could tell the story. I started writing it. It was, the first draft was very quick. It just came out of me. And so I just think there's something about the story that I thought was not only worth the time to write as a screenplay, but worth the time to fight for 20 years to get on the screen. You know, there were so many times that everybody should have given up, but nobody did. And, you know, what I think is the unsung, you know, one of the unsung heroes behind the movie, you know, the heroes are the real people. Mike Burden, Judy Burden, the Reverend David Kennedy, Clarence Simpson, who's portrayed as, in the movie as well by Usher, and the congregation. But an unsung person is Robbie Brenner, who's my producer. And she, when she came on board in 2004, she just never let go. She just wouldn't stop fighting to get this movie made. Even when I was like, look, it's over. You know, the movie's fallen apart three times. Obama is now the president of the United States. Forget it. No one cares. She's like, people will care. And so, you know, we both fought together, but really, like, you know, we're a tag team of can't be done, it can be done, it can't be done, let's do it.
It's so interesting that you say that. Obama's president, and suddenly racism has disappeared from the United States, right? I mean, I remember thinking of that fantasy, you know, myself. But you really needed Trump to kind of get this movie back in people's minds.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, you know.
Good answer.
I mean, so yeah, the, you know, what was funny is how many condolence calls I got for Burden when Obama won the presidency. Mm. And if you really had asked me in 2004, 2005, when will there be an African-American president, I would have said, I don't know, 2050? Mm. Maybe. So the fact that in 2008 we elected an African-American president was beyond, you know, crazy. And if not for who he was, mm-hmm. I mean, because he was so charismatic, probably wouldn't have happened, you know. And maybe it was premature, to be honest. So, you know, I got condolence calls, but there were still a lot of people who were interested in Megan Bird. You know, I think that what we've seen now is what we thought was small town America. You know, racism in small southern town America is now everywhere. I firmly believe this is not a political movie. It's not a political response to anybody because...
Of course, and I'm not trying to make it one. No, I just never had this conversation before about a film. So.
Right, and you're not wrong. I mean, you know, in the past several years and while we were making the movie, it was the 2016 election, we were making the movie in a very, very small town in Georgia. Where locker up signs were, you know, all over front yards. You know, what I think happened here is, you know, that everybody stuffed political correctness down everybody's throat so deeply that this is, you know, this is us, you know, in lack of any tact here, throwing up political correctness and going, I want to scream and I want to rant and rave. I want to be 4 years old again and have that freedom just to rant and rave. Burden, thankfully, you know, I like to say a lot of times, you know, what's good for the world is bad for Burden. What's good for Burden is bad for the world, in terms of relevance. And this is not uniquely United States. I have people coming up to me when we screen the movie, crying, weeping from South Africa. This is happening here, England. You know, this is happening here. You know, especially with the refugee crises and the onslaughts of migrants, you know, around the world, it's happening here, Europe. I mean, people really gravitate to the idea that, you know, racism, bigotry, fear of the other is what I really think it is relevant. And I don't just, it's hard for me to articulate this, but name calling isn't getting us anywhere. You're liberal, you're conservative, you're Republican, you're Democrat, you're an idiot, you know, you're not, you know, you're intellectual. I mean, that's actually, you know, a derogatory comment now, you're an intellectual. But, you know, the truth is that you have to really listen and you really have to try to understand what's going on here. And for me, you know, I'll never forget it, and it's sort of articulated in the movie, but Clarence Simpson, who, you know, was a deacon at the church and spent a lot of time with me driving around, that's how I got to know the gray area of the movie. Mm. You know, it from a northern perspective, and you see it with, you know, some reviews, and you see it with some friends of mine or you know, California perspective, the Klan is just bad. You know, they hate all African Americans and they just want to kill them. Well, that's not what's going on at all. Mm. And I really realized that by spending time down there. And that's why I do it. You know, so, you know, Clarence is like, look, he said, go to the Joanna Diner and see some Klan. So I went and put on some, you know, look sort of Klan. And I went to the Joanna Diner, which is the town next door, to see the Klan. Mm. And there was a diner with all African Americans. You know, it's one of those diners, you take a train, you go around, and all African Americans serving, and a lot of, you know, honestly, a lot of white people and hunting gear and fishing gear, and work gear, work clothes, blue collar guys.
I love that you as an actor were able to dress the part.
Oh, totally.
Great.
No, totally. I mean, I do it quite a bit, you know, to my, you know, detriment or to, you know, physical peril. But, you know, I feel like let's go there and see what it is. And so, I mean, there's pictures of me back then, 20 years younger, looking quite, you know, like I could have been the guy next door, in Joanna. But in the middle of all these guys is an African-American around 65 years old in fishing outfit. And he's just telling stories. I could barely understand him. I mean, his Southern dialect was so deep. And everybody's laughing. Everybody was laughing. And I left and I called Clarence and I said, what are you talking about? There was a black guy in the middle entertaining everybody. There were black people serving lunch. It's not like they hated anybody there. He goes, exactly my point. Mm. They hate change. Mm-hmm. They would love it. The Klan doesn't want to kill all black people. The Klan wanted it to be 1940, 1950. They just wish that nothing had changed. And so the fact that he's entertaining everybody, that's his job. That's what makes him, that's what they love. You know, the fact that they're serving you lunch, that's what they love. And so it wasn't about, you know, any Klansman or any white person wanting to kill all black people for Clarence or for anybody. It was about the fact that they don't want change. And that's a very different concept when you think about it. You know, I'm not saying better or worse, but for me as a filmmaker, very different concept than the evil Klan that's showing around killing all people. You know, that's not what was reality.
Well, I do have to applaud your writing because you had a pretty unlikable protagonist in Mike, and you were able to take us on this journey. And I remember the moment we meet him, and then the two kids are in the back of the pickup truck, and he goes over to the kids and he's like, don't push him down, you're hurting him, or whatever he says. And I'm like, okay, that's good writing, because you're showing us who he is in his heart. But we don't find out, I think, for another 10-15 minutes that he's in the Klan. And when you do, you feel so dirty because you're sitting there going, oh, I was kind of liking this guy, he's good looking, you know. It really puts you in this moral quandary, like, oh my God, where am I? And that's very, very difficult to do.
Well, yeah.
Congratulations.
And thank you for noticing, you know, that it's one thing to be a trick and it's another thing not to be. And so what I realized, and I realized this because, again, I was unfortunate enough to have, you know, 18 years between thinking of the story and filming it. And in one of our readings, I'll never forget that it just dawned on me. I wanted to try something different. I didn't tell the African-American actors. I pulled all the white actors out and I said, here's what I want you to play. I want you to play it as if you're the high school heroes. Mm-hmm. You're the prom king, Mike. You know, you're the captain of the football team, Clint. You're the funny guys. You're the guys that everybody loves. Tom, you're the coach. And I want to see what that feels like if you don't play the bad guy, if you don't play evil. I want to see what that does. And so they did it. And I told them improv, and they were joking around the entire time, and all of the African-American actors were laughing with them, and we were having a really good time. And the first line that, the first racist line in the movie is Clint's, when he says those ends always with a handout. And it was hilarious, because they were all having such a good time that when he says that line, mm-hmm. it was as though, you know, the record scratched. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget how upset the African-American actors got at hearing it, that it was twice as hard to hear it from guys that they were just laughing at. And I thought, this is the secret. This is the key to telling the story, is how do you make them human before you drop the bomb on their inhuman attitudes?
Again, it's very tricky to do, and your innate understanding of character and conflict, I think from all your years in the theater, just really served you well in this story.
Thanks, yeah. And look, you know, it's a brutal realization when you sort of realize that you're rooting for the bad guy.
Right. But you also, in your mind, I'm going, okay, a lot's got to change here. Mm-hmm. Like, there's going to have to be a definite arc.
Yeah, something has to happen.
And it's the story and the entertainment is watching how that arc comes about and what he, how low he has to get before he, you know, makes that change.
Oh, for sure. And I don't make it easy on you guys.
Mm-mm. How did you get these wonderful British actors that played Tom and Judy, Andrea Riseborough, yeah, and Tom Wilkinson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, Tom's pretty easy. As we were, you know, going through the election cycle in 2016, we were filming in October. I mean, we were filming through the election. And honestly, the American actors that I wanted to play Tom in the movie just wouldn't have it, no matter how much I argued.
Oh, interesting.
No matter how much I said, and there's an actor who will remain nameless, because, but he was great. He was a big star. And he kept emailing me personally going, thanks, but no thanks. And I kept emailing him back going, but don't you understand that being in this movie is planting a flag on the side of tolerance, and no one blames Ralph Fiennes for his portrayal of Schindler's List. It's obvious he's supporting, you know, he's not a Nazi in real life. And finally he wrote me back going, thank you, but I'm not playing this role. Stop writing me. Thank you.
So many actors want to be liked.
Well, you know, in his defense and in all of their defenses, it was part of that, I think, but it was bigger part was they're such real actors that they kept telling me, I don't want to be a Klansman. I don't want to put those clothes on right now, that skin on right now. Right. I just don't want to do it right now. I don't feel right. So we started looking outside the United States.
Makes sense.
And we sent it to Tom Wilkinson almost first because he's an amazing actor. And also, I didn't want someone you would consider evil. Like when you see him on the screen, you go, that's a bad guy. And Tom is not that guy. And Tom literally read it without meeting me and said, I'll do this movie. I love the writing. And when I talked to him, he said, Andrew, you don't know, but the screenplay is 90% of the movie. And so I know this is going to be a good movie even without meeting you. And I said, okay, thank you. Very British of him. But he, you know, he really came with an attitude. Not, you know, we worked on it together where I said, I don't want you to play a Klansman. I want you to play a Southerner who's losing his son. Mm. Which is, you know, that's what he played. And certain scenes, as you've seen, are eerily, you know, they're eerie because they're weird. There's a scene when Tom is trying to get him back. And it really feels like, and I told Tom this, as he said it, right after he said it, I said, it's so weird hearing you say this because it's almost as if the intention is, please stop doing drugs, son, and come home. Go to rehab and stop doing drugs. But it's couched in, you know, it's just racist. Mm. And so it's a very strange feeling you're projecting to the audience, and I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it because it's human.
Yeah, gosh.
Again, like I say, I'm not trying to humanize the actions or the attitude or the Klan at all. What I'm trying to do is say that there's people, and how can you change a person if you're just gonna, you know, if you wanna make a superhero, if you want good and evil, put the capes on, put the masks on, let's make a superhero movie. These are about people. And so again, you know, you're vulnerable to being hijacked if you don't have anything. And so that economics is for me a huge issue in that. You know, Clarence said this line, it's reflected in the movie, but the line he actually said was, I feel sorry for them boys. Mm. And I almost fell out of his car. I'm like, why do you feel sorry for the Klan? And this is an African-American deacon at a church that has been basically terrorized by these people. And he said, because, you know, Southern male, poor, black, supposed to be. Southern male, poor, white, ain't supposed to be. And, you know, he said, you know, basically the only way they feel better about anything, these guys, is by thinking that they're better than we are.
Yeah.
And that's the only solace they have. So with that knowledge, again, you have to go down there, you have to figure it out, or else, because sitting in my, you know, in my office in Hollywood writing this movie never would have happened. It just wouldn't have been the movie. It would have been Klan's evil, you know, how do we like make the evil guys pay and, you know, all that nonsense.
I want to ask you about the Sundance experience. Mm-hmm. You won the Audience Award.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Had you been to Sundance with the project before?
Nope.
How did you get in it?
How did we get into Sundance?
Yeah.
You know, I feel very blessed, knock on wood, but I feel very blessed with our whole journey here. Again, I have an unsung hero named Robbie Brenner. And Robbie is a producer who's, you know, incredibly experienced, years and years. And as a woman, and I'm going to say it, you know, she had to fight for everything she got. You know, she was, a really powerful independent producer. She worked with Harvey Weinstein, you know. She was at Miramax. She came up from there. She went independent. She went to Fox. I mean, she's done it all, studio and small budget movies. But she did Dallas Buyers Club. So, you know, when she got nominated for an Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club, that morning, she texted me and said, "You're next."
Wow.
And she had been, you know, on Burden since 2004, so it's 10 years later. And so after we made the movie and after we were lucky enough to get the cast we got, we had submitted to a bunch of festivals and they were deciding, you know, to get in or not. And of course, because Robbie knows everybody, she got us a great publicist, and we had, you know, great people behind it at the agencies, et cetera, and so forth. And so we then got a note back from Sundance, which we had submitted to, you know, really early in the process, saying, "We're accepting your movie, and not only are we accepting it, but we're accepting it into dramatic competition."
That's
which was
great.
The big one. And so we decided to blow off every other thing and wait for Sundance, which we did. And so, again, you know, I don't think this happens with a lot of filmmakers, but, you know, I had a pretty easy road of it heading to Sundance. We had put in, you know, a lot of work and a lot of time and editing, and making the movie was incredibly difficult because we didn't have that much money or that many days, and we had a really seasoned cast with a first-time filmmaker. But, you know, it all was an amazing experience, and as far as the Audience Award and the award show, the truth is, and I don't know if I've said it before, but we weren't. My family came up the second weekend because I had to stay the whole time. My agents were like, "You're staying the whole time. Why would you leave?" And I'm like, "Because I want to get home."
And I've so seen the movie.
Yeah, they came up the second weekend, and we skied, and we were exhausted, and there was some sort of awards dinner. That, you know, the publicist, everybody had left me there. I was there alone and with my family. So I said to my wife, who didn't, was like, I said, let's just go to dinner. And she said, well, why don't we stop by? I said, okay, we'll stop by. We'll have appetizers with all the filmmakers and we'll say hi to them. And then we'll leave. And we get there and it's a huge awards show. It's like the Oscars. I mean, it's a huge show with an audience, a paid audience, and it's big. And there's a, you know, an MC in the whole nine yards, and there's high, you know, it's an award show, which we weren't expecting. And so we had dinner and sat down, and my little girl was 8 at the time, and she fell asleep on my lap, and I was spacing out, and my wife elbowed me and said, "I think you won." And I had to give my daughter, who was asleep on my lap, to my wife and go up and accept an award that, you know, it was funny because halfway through I thought to myself, there are speeches here, people have notes and there are cards, and this is crazy. But I didn't have a thing. And so it is one of those weirdo sort of things where you see someone get up and it's online and stumble around for a while until I figured I won the award, and I had nothing prepared, and I wasn't even going, and I'm dressed very casually, and the whole thing was quite a shock to me. What is funny is my agent predicted, he kept saying the whole week, "You're going to win the Audience Award. You're going to win the Audience Award." And I kept saying, "Will you shut up? I'm not winning anything. We're just here, you know, getting this movie shown." And so when I was walking off stage, I leaned back and I'm like, "Sulco, you were right," because he just kept saying it over and over again. So it was pretty funny.
I would imagine that working on the screenplay probably took, you said the first draft came pretty quickly to you, which is great. What advice do you have to first-time filmmakers when they're sitting down to write their screenplay?
Well, the first thing is you better believe in it. I mean, you really better. My biggest piece of advice, but it only works for me, you know, I'll never forget, I had an acting teacher He used to give us a template. But what I loved about him was he didn't guru himself. So he would say, like, you know, I knew a guy who stared at his hand before he went on stage, and he was brilliant. So if you can stare at your hand and be brilliant, stare at your hand. And so this is the same, you know, the same way. If you can stare at your hand and write a screenplay, stare at your hand. For me, I like to go. I like to go and see it. I like to go and soak in the environment. If I can soak in the real people, I do it. You know, there's so much you can get. So many kernels you can get from the real people and the real environment that will help you just craft the scenes, help you just craft the ideas. And I'm an unusual writer. I don't, you know, in terms of story structure, I save that for the edit.
Interesting. So you didn't worry about it on the page?
No, no, I can't. I'm not that kind of a person. I don't go act one, act two, act three, and I don't page count. I've studied it all. But, you know, again, same acting teacher. The advice that he gave me, I'll give to you guys, which is, you know, he said, I used to box when I was acting. Now, not great for your physical appearance, but he said, that's the best training you can do. Boxing is you work hard, you train for a fight, you know tendencies, you study them, you train as hard as you can, you practice. So when you get in the ring, you can throw it all out. And what I took away from that as an actor was obvious, but as a screenwriter and as a filmmaker, it's do your preparation, and then you know it intrinsically. The three-act structure is not because someone made it up out of thin air. It's because that's how stories are told. So if you know it, and if you've studied it, and you believe in it, you're going to tell a story in that way.
Right.
You know, and so I never... I don't follow it when I'm writing the first draft. I just write the first draft. And sometimes it can get you in a lot of trouble. For instance, my first draft of the screenplay that I wrote after Burden, or recently, was 190 pages. and that's trouble. You know, and I realized that's trouble until, of course, I saw The Irishman, in which case I could have just made the movie.
Right.
But I cut it down to 125.
I think that was a good choice.
And so, you know... That's me, but I'm not everybody. And I have friends who are day-to-day writers and day-to-day screenwriters and day-to-day television writers, and they follow a very specific framework. Yeah. I don't. I'm an emotional writer, is what I try to think about it like that. You know, I wrote a lot of poetry when I was younger, and it was all emotional. And then I was roommates with a poetry major in college who graduated with a PhD in poetry, and he couldn't write when he was upset.
Interesting.
He said it would violate structure. And me, I could only write when I was emotional in terms of writing poetry. So it's the same thing for me as a screenwriter. I think I really enjoy what I call vomiting out my first draft. I really do not enjoy editing it.
Most of us don't. Well, do you think you'll continue writing and directing? You gonna star in anything? You write for yourself?
You know, I'm in Burden, but not by choice. I'm in Burden because when you do an independent movie, you shoot however you can. And so on day two, we had to shoot one of the most difficult climactic scenes with Garrett Hedlund. And sort of an extra who is a lawyer, because you only hear his voice. And as we started rehearsing it, I realized that this actor Garrett didn't know him, it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know what, I'll do you want me to play the lawyer? And Garrett said, yeah. And so I ended up playing the lawyer. So they kept putting me in makeup, and I'm like, I'm not going to be seen. They're, well, you never know. I'm like, actually, I do, because I'm the director and I'm going to edit the movie. So you're wasting your time. But it was very effective for Garrett. And, you know, just in terms of Garrett Hedlund, by the way, you know, he's my everything in Burden. You know, all of the actors propped me up. I got very lucky. They all came to play. They all believed in it. They shared the same passion that I did. And that's really important. From actors to crew to producers, if they're not passionate about the subject you're telling as an independent filmmaker, get rid of them. And get rid of them quickly. Fire them. Get people that want to do this. Because with independent film, you can't afford to have someone dial it in. It's, we had to cut people out of the movie because they just weren't up to it. And Garrett, you know, is a god in terms of not only just, you know, his performance, but the work ethic, you know, that he came with everything. And I, you know, I can never thank him enough for that, for my first feature, or for any feature, but for the first one. And as far as more, yeah, I've got two that are done. They're written, one is cast. And we're just finishing up, hopefully, the financing. I will not be in it. Maybe I'll give myself a small something, just because it saves us money. And then the other one is a bigger project that I wrote and I'm going to direct as well.
Great. Well done. I wish you nothing but the best of luck with Burden. Where can people see it?
So it's coming out in New York and LA on February 28th, and then it's expanding nationwide in the next couple weeks. It's awesome. It's an old-fashioned, you know, it's an old-fashioned rollout. So it's two cities, 13 cities, and then on and on, and hopefully, you know, going all the way through Easter, which would be great.
Great. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me.